dead set against this wedding, so don't waste your breath, Linny May. Merrick often addressed her mother as Linny May. The twisted sound of the name in her mouth somehow managed to imply all of her mother's shortcomings. Her twangy voice, her feed sack-looking dresses, her backwoods pronunciations like supposedly and et cetera and desk is. Abby felt bad for Mrs. Whitshank, but Mrs. Whitshank herself didn't appear to take offense. "I'm just saying," she said mildly, and she slid a handful of okra spokes into the bowl of milk. Merrick took a deep drag of her cigarette and blew smoke toward the ceiling. "Anyhow," Abby told Merrick, "I bet it was one of those dreams you were really glad to wake up from, wasn't it?" Merrick said, "Mm-hmm," with her eyes on the fan blade spinning above her. Then a girl's voice called, "Mayor? Hello?" And Merrick straightened and called, "In the kitchen." The screen door slammed, and a moment later, Pixie Kincaid and Maddie Lane arrived in the kitchen, both wearing Bermuda shorts, Maddie carrying a powder blue Samsonite vanity case. "Merrick Whitshank, you're still in your bathrobe?" Pixie said. "I didn't get home from the party till after 3 in the morning. "Well, neither did we, but it's almost 10. Did you forget we're practicing your makeup today?"
"I remember," Merrick said. She stubbed out her cigarette. "Come on upstairs and let's do this."
"Hi, Mrs. Whitshank," Pixie said belatedly. "Hi, Abby. See you later."
Maddie just gave a little wave, like a windshield wiper. Then the three of them walked out, Merrick's heels clattering. A sudden quiet descended.
"I guess Merrick must be feeling kind of tense these days," Abby said after a moment.
"Oh, no. That's just how she is,"
Mrs. Whitshank said cheerfully. She had finished slicing the okra. She stirred the slices around in the milk, using a slotted spoon.
"She was a snippy little girl, and now she's a snippy big girl," she said. "Nothing much I can do about it."
She began transferring the okra slices to the cornmeal mixture.
"Sometimes," she said, "it seems to me there's just these certain types of people that come around and around in our lives. Know what I mean? Easy types and hard types. We run into them over and over. Merrick's always put me in mind of my Granny Inman. Disapproving kind of woman. Tongue like a rasp. She never did think much of me. You, now, you're a sympathizer, same as my Aunt Louise."
"Oh," Abby said. "Yes, I see what you're saying. It's kind of like reincarnation,"
Mrs. Whitshank said.
"Well,
except it's within one single lifetime instead of spread out over different lifetimes."
"Well, maybe," Mrs. Whitshank said.
Then she said, "Honey, you want to do something for me?"
"Anything," Abby said.
"Fetch that pitcher of water from the icebox and those paper cups on the counter and take them out to the men, will you? I know they must be dying of thirst. And tell them lunch will be early. I'll bet they're wondering."
Abby stood up and went to the refrigerator. Her stockings were sticking damply to the backs of her legs. It might not have been the best idea to wear them on a day like today. As she was crossing the front hall, she overheard Mr. Whitshank talking on the phone in the sunroom.
"This afternoon? What the hell?" he was saying. "God damn it, Mitch! I've got 5 men out there waiting on you to tell them how to do that tree stump."
Abby made her footsteps lighter, thinking he might be embarrassed that she'd caught him using swear words. Outside, the air hit her face like a warm washcloth, and the porch floorboards gave off the smell of hot varnish. But the soft, fresh breeze, unusual for this time of year, lifted the damp wisps along her hairline, and the water pitcher she was hugging chilled the insides of her arms. Landis had gotten hold of a second chainsaw from somewhere and he and Earl were slicing the thickest branches into fireplace-size logs. Dane and Ward were hacking off the thinner branches and dragging them to a huge pile down near the street, while Red had set up a chopping block and was splitting the logs into quarters. They all stopped work when Abby arrived. Earl and Landis killed their chainsaws, and a ringing silence fell, so that her voice sounded shockingly clear. "Anybody want water?"
"I wouldn't say no,"
Earl told her, and they set down their tools and came over to her. Ward had taken his shirt off, which made him look like an amateur, and he and Dane were deeply flushed. Red, of course, had been working this hard the whole summer, but even he had rivulets of sweat running down his face, and Earl and Landis were so drenched that their blue chambray shirts were almost navy. She distributed paper cups and then filled them while the men held them out, and they emptied them in one gulp and held them out again before she'd finished the first round. It wasn't till halfway through the third round that anyone said more than, "Thanks." Then Red asked,
"Did Dad get a hold of Mitch, do you know?"
"I think he's on the phone with him now."
"I still say we just go ahead and take the whole thing down," Earl told Red. "Well, I don't want Mitch showing up and saying we made his job harder."
Dane and Abby were looking at each other. Dane's hair was damp, and he gave off a wonderful smell of clean sweat and tobacco. Abby had a sudden, worrisome thought. She didn't own any nice underwear. Just plain white cotton underpants and white cotton bras with the tiniest pink rosebud stitched to the center V. She looked away again.
"Hello?"
It was a beefy man in a seersucker suit, parting the azalea hedge that bordered the lawn next door. Twigs crackled under his chalk-white shoes as he walked toward them.
"Say there," he said when he reached them.
He had his eyes fixed specifically on Red.
"Hi, Mr. Barkalow," Red said. "Wonder if you realize what time your men started work this morning?"
Landis was the one who answered.
8 o'clock," he said.
8 o'clock," Mr. Barkalow repeated, still looking at Red. Landis said,
"That's when me and Red and Earl here started. The rest of them showed up later."
8 o'clock in the morning," Mr. Barkalow said.
"A Sunday morning. A weekend. Does that strike you as acceptable?"
"Well, it seems okay to me, sir," Red said in a steady voice.
"Is that right? 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning seems a fine time to run a chainsaw."
He had ginger eyebrows that bristled out aggressively, but Red didn't seem intimidated. He said,
"I figured most folks would be."
"Morning there," Mr. Whitshank called.
He was striding toward them down the slope of the lawn, wearing a black suit coat that must have been put on in haste. The left lapel was turned wrong, like a dog's ear flipped inside out.
"Fine day," he said to Mr. Barkalow. "Good to see you out enjoying it."
"I was just asking your son, Mr. Whitshank, what he considers to be an acceptable hour to run a chainsaw."
"Oh, why? Is there a problem?"
"The problem is that today is Sunday. I don't know if you're aware of it," Mr. Barkalow said.
He had transferred his bushy-browed glare to Mr. Whitshank, who was nodding emphatically as if he couldn't agree more.
"Yes, well, we certainly wouldn't want to," he said.
"It is perverse how you people love to make a racket while the rest of us are trying to sleep. You're hammering on your gutters. You're drilling out your flagstones. Only yesterday you sawed an entire tree down, a perfectly healthy tree, might I add, and always, always it seems to happen on a weekend."
Mr. Whitshank suddenly grew taller.
"It doesn't seem to happen on a weekend. It does happen on a weekend," he said. "That's the only time we honest laboring men aren't busy, doing you folks' work for you.
You ought to thank your lucky stars I don't report you to the police, Mr. Barkalow said.
They're bound to have ordinances dealing with this kind of thing.
Ordinances? Don't make me laugh. Just because you all like to lie abed till noon, you and that spoiled son of yours with his big fat...
When you think about it, Red broke in, it doesn't really matter if there are ordinances or there aren't.
Both men looked at him.
What matters is we seem to be waking our neighbors. I'm sorry about that, Mr. Barkalow. We certainly never intended to discommode you.
Discommode?
His father repeated in a marveling voice. Red said, I wonder if we could settle on an hour that's mutually agreeable.
Mutually agreeable? His father echoed.
Oh, Mr. Barkalow said. Well, does maybe 10 o'clock sound all right? Red asked him.
10 o'clock,
Mr. Whitshank said.
10, Mr. Barkalow said. Oh, well, even 10 is... But, well, I guess we could tolerate 10 if we were forced to.
Mr. Whitshank looked up at the sky as if he were begging for mercy. But Red said,
10 o'clock. It's a deal. We'll make sure to abide by that in the future, Mr. Barkalow.
Well,
Mr. Barkalow said. He seemed uncertain. He glanced again at Mr. Whitshank, and then he said,
Well, okay then. I guess that settles it.
And he turned and walked off toward the hedge.
Now see what you've done, Mr. Whitshank told Red. 10 o'clock, for God's sake, practically lunchtime.
Red handed his paper cup to Abby without comment. Landis said,
boss?
What is it?
Mr. Whitshank said.
Did you get the word from Mitch?
He's coming by this afternoon with his brother-in-law's stump grinder. He says take the trunk on down.
So cut it low to the ground?
Low as you can get it,
Mr. Whitshank said. And by then he had already turned away and was halfway up the hill again, as if he'd washed his hands of all of them. The hem of his suit coat hung unevenly, Abby noticed, sagging at the sides and hitching up at the center, as if it belonged to a much older and shabbier man. She circulated among the others, collecting their paper cups in silence, and then she started back up the hill herself.
Sometimes Junior thinks the neighbors might be looking down their noses at him, Mrs. Whitshank said when she heard about the scene in the yard. He's a little bit sensitive that way.
Abby didn't say so, but she could see his side of it. During her years as a scholarship student, she'd had a few dealings herself with Mr. Barkalow's type. So entitled, so convinced that there was only one way to live. No doubt all his sons played lacrosse, and all his daughters were preparing for their debutante balls. But she shook that thought away and folded the sheet of dough on the counter a second time and a third.
Fold, fold, and fold again,
were Mrs. Whitshank's instructions when she'd taught Abby how to make her biscuits.
Fold till, when you slap the dough, you hear it give a burp.
Anyhow, Abby said, Red got them to compromise. It all worked out in the end.
Red is not so quick to take offense,
Mrs. Whitshank said. She drew a large bowl from the refrigerator and removed the dish towel that covered it.
I think it's because he grew up here. He's used to people like the Barkalows.
The bowl contained pieces of chicken in a liquid white batter. Mrs. Whitshank lifted them out one by one with canning tongs and laid them on a platter to drain.
It's like he's comfortable with both sorts, she said, with the neighbors and with the work crew. I know if he had his way, though, he'd quit college right this minute and go on the work crew full time.
It's only on account of Junior that he's sticking it out till graduation.
Well, it never hurts to have a diploma,
Abby said.
That's what Junior tells him. He says, you want the option of something better. You don't want to end up like me, he says. Red says, what's wrong with ending up like you? He says the trouble with college is it's not practical. The people there aren't practical. Sometimes they strike me as silly, he says.
Abby had never heard Red talk about college. He was 2 years ahead of her, and they seldom ran into each other on campus.
What are his grades like? She asked Mrs. Whitshank.
Mrs. Whitshank said, they're okay.
Well, so-so. That's just not how his mind works, you know? He's the kind that you show him some gadget he's never laid eyes on before, and he says, oh, I see, yes, this part goes into that part, and then it connects with this other part. Just like his daddy. But his daddy wants Red to be different from him. Isn't that always how it is?
I bet Red was one of those little boys who take the kitchen clock apart, Abby said.
Yes, except he could put it back together again, too, which most other little boys can't. Oops, watch what you're doing, Abby. I see how you're twisting that glass.
She meant the glass that Abby was using to cut out the biscuits.
Clamp it straight down on the dough, remember? She said.
Sorry.
Let me fetch you the skillet.
Abby wiped her forehead with the back of her hand. The kitchen was heating up, and she was swathed in one of Mrs. Whitshank's bib aprons. If it was true, Abby thought, that she represented a recurring figure in Mrs. Whitshank's life, the sympathizer, it was equally true that Mrs. Whitshank's type had shown up before in Abby's life, the instructive older woman, the grandmother who had taught her to knit, the English teacher who had stayed late to help her with her poems. More patient and softer spoken than Abby's brisk, efficient mother, they had guided and encouraged her, like Mrs. Whitshank saying now, oh, those are looking good, good as any I could have made. Maybe Red could join his dad's company full-time after college, Abby said. Then it could be Whitshank and Son Construction. Wouldn't Mr. Whitshank like that?
I don't think so, Mrs. Whitshank said. He's hoping the law for Red.
Law or business, one.
Red's got a fine head for business.
But if he wouldn't be happy, Abby said.
Junior says happiness is neither here nor there, Mrs. Whitshank told her. He says Red should just make up his mind to be happy.
Then she stopped hunting through the utensil drawer and said,
I'm not trying to make him sound mean.
Of course not, Abby said.
He only wants what's best for his family, you know? We're all he's got.
Well, of course. Neither one of us has to do with our own families anymore.
Why is that? Abby asked.
Oh, just, you know, circumstances. We kind of fell out of touch with them, Mrs. Whitshank said. They're clear down in North Carolina, and besides, my side were never in favor of us being together.
You mean you and Mr. Whitshank?
Just like Romeo and Juliet, Mrs. Whitshank said.
She laughed, but then she sobered and said,
Now here is something you might not know.
Guess how old Juliet was when she fell in love with Romeo?
13, Abby said promptly.
Oh,
they taught us that in school.
They taught Merrick that, too, in 10th grade, Mrs. Whitshank said. She came home and told me. She said, isn't that ridiculous? She said that after she heard that, she couldn't take Shakespeare seriously.
Well, I don't know why not, Abby said. A person can fall in love at 13.
Yes, a person can.
Like me.
You?
I was 13 when I fell in love with Junior, Mrs. Whitshank said.
That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Oh, goodness! And here you are now, married to him, Abby said. That's amazing. How old was Mr. Whitshank?
26.
Abby took a moment to absorb this.
He was 26 when you were 13?
26 years old, Mrs. Whitshank said.
Abby said,
Oh, isn't that something?
Yes, it is, Abby said. He was this real good-looking guy, a little bit wild, worked at the lumber yard, but only just sometimes. Rest of the time he was off hunting and fishing and trapping and getting himself into trouble. Well, you see the attraction. Who could resist a boy like that? Especially when you're 13. And I was a kind of developed 13. I developed real early. I met him at a church picnic when he came with another girl, and it was love at first sight for both of us. He started up with me right then and there. After that, we would sneak off together every chance we got. Oh, we couldn't keep our hands off each other. But one night my daddy found us.
Found you where? Abby asked.
Well, in the hay barn. But he found us. You know,
Mrs. Whitshank fluttered a hand in the air.
Oh, it was awful, she said merrily. It was like something out of a movie. My daddy held a gun to his neck. Then daddy and my brothers ran him out of Yancey County. Can you believe it? La, I think back on that now, and it feels like it happened to somebody else. Was that me? I say to myself. I didn't lay eyes on him again for close on to 5 years.
Abby had slacked off on the biscuit cutting. She was just standing there staring at Mrs. Whitshank. So Mrs. Whitshank took the glass from her and stepped in to finish up, making short work of it. Clamp, clamp.
But you kept in touch, Abby said.
Oh, no. I had no idea where he was.
Mrs. Whitshank was laying the biscuits in the greased skillet, edge to edge in concentric circles.
I stayed faithful to him, though. I never forgot him for 1 minute.
Oh, we had one of the world's great love stories, in our little way. And once we got back together again, it was like we'd never parted. You know how that happens sometimes. We took up right where we left off, the same as ever.
Abby said,
But
had it never crossed Mrs. Whitshank's mind that what she was describing was,
well, a crime?
Mrs. Whitshank said,
I don't know why I'm telling you, though. It's supposed to be a secret. I've never even told my own children.
Oh, especially my own children. Merrick would make fun of me. Promise you won't tell them, Abby. Swear it on your life.
I won't tell a soul, Abby said.
She wouldn't have known what words to use, even. It was all too extreme and disturbing. Mr. and Mrs. Whitshank and Red, Earl and Landis, Ward, Dane, and Abby, 8 people for lunch. Merrick would not be eating with them, Mrs. Whitshank said. Abby traveled around the table, doling out knives and forks. The Whitshank's silverware was real sterling, embossed with an old English W. She wondered when they had acquired it. Not at the time of their wedding, presumably. Her parents just had dime store cutlery, not all of it even matching. Suddenly, she felt homesick for her bustling, sensible mother and her kindly father, with his shirt pocket full of ballpoint pens and mechanical pencils. All the dining room windows were open, the curtains wafting inward on the breeze, and she could see out to the porch, where Pixie and Maddie sat in the swing with their backs to her, talking in soft, lazy voices. Merrick's makeup session must be finished. Abby heard the shower running upstairs. She went to the kitchen for plates, and as she returned, one of the chainsaws roared to life again. Till then, she hadn't noticed the silence. The noise was so close that she bent to peer out a window and see what was going on. Apparently, the men were tackling what remained of the trunk. Landis stood to the left, watching, while Earl stooped low with his saw. He was working on the far side of the tree,
nearly out of her angle of vision, probably cutting a notch so it would fall away from the house, but Abby couldn't be sure from where she stood. She always worried men would get crushed doing that, although these two certainly looked as if they knew what they were doing. She set the plates around and then counted out napkins from the sideboard and laid one beside each fork. She returned to the kitchen and asked Mrs. Whitshank, "Shall I pour the iced tea now?"
"No, let's wait a bit," Mrs. Whitshank said. She was standing at the stove frying chicken. "Go sit on the porch and cool off, why don't you? I'll call you when it's time."
Abby didn't argue. She was glad to leave the hot kitchen. She untied her apron and draped it over the back of a chair, and then she went out to the porch and settled in one of the rockers some distance from Pixie and Maddie. She looked for Dane and found him hauling a huge leafy branch down toward the pile near the street. His hair took on an almost metallic sheen when he stepped into a shaft of sunshine. What would she tell her mother? "I'm going to spend the night at Ruth's," she could say, except that then her mother might phone her at Ruth's. It had been known to happen. And even if Abby dared to ask Ruth to cover for her, there was the problem of Ruth's parents. Red was tossing split logs into a wheelbarrow. Ward was mopping his forehead with his balled-up shirt. Earl killed the chainsaw just as Merrick stepped onto the porch and said, "Phew!" letting the screen door slam behind her. "Feels like I've washed a rubber mask off my face," she told Pixie and Maddie. She was eating from a bowl of cornflakes. She walked over to a cane-bottomed chair, hooked it with one foot, and pulled it closer to the swing and sat down. Her hair was still in curlers, but she had on Bermudas now and a sleeveless white blouse. "We were just wondering who the James Dean was," Pixie told her.
"The who?" "Oh, that's Dane. He's gorgeous."
"If next Saturday's like today," Merrick said, "my foundation's going to streak clear off my face, and my mascara will give me raccoon eyes."
"You'll match your mother-in-law," Maddie said with a giggle.
"Oh, just go ahead and kill me if I ever get circles like hers," Merrick said. "You know what I suspect? I suspect she paints them on. She's one of those people who like to look sick. She's always trotting off to her doctor, and of course he tells her she's fine. But when she comes back, she says, 'Well, he thinks I'll be all right.'"
"Will he be at the wedding?" Pixie asked.
"Will who be at the wedding?"
"That Dane person."
"Oh, I don't know. Will Dane be at the wedding?" Merrick called down the porch to Abby.
Abby said, "He wasn't invited."
"He wasn't? Well, feel free to bring him if you like."
"Oh, you two go together?"
Pixie asked Abby. Abby gave a half shrug, hoping to imply that they did go together, but that she could take him or leave him, and Pixie heaved a theatrical sigh of disappointment. "Now, here is the $64 question," Merrick said. "My curlers."
"What about them?" Maddie asked.
"You see how big and bobbly they are. I've been going to bed in these since I was 14 years old. My hair is straight as a stick otherwise. What am I going to do on my wedding night, is the question."
"Ask me something hard," Maddie said. "You go to bed without them, silly.
Then early in the morning, you wake up before Trey does, and you sneak off to the bathroom and put your curlers in and take a hot shower. Don't actually wet your hair, just steam it. Then get under the hairdryer." "You'll have to slip your hairdryer into the bathroom the night before."
"I can't bring my hairdryer on my honeymoon. It needs its own huge suitcase."
"Then buy yourself one of those new kinds that you can hold in your hand."
"What, and electrocute myself like that woman in the paper?
Besides, you don't know how stubborn my hair is. 2 minutes of steam won't have any effect at all." Pixie said, "You should do your hair like her."
"Like who?"
"Her," Pixie said, poking her chin in Abby's direction. She was wearing a little smirk.
"Abby."
Merrick didn't bother responding to that. If I could just get away from Trey for a couple of measly hours, she said. If there was a beauty parlor in the hotel and it opened at 5 in the morning. The chainsaw roared up again, drowning out the rest of her words. Landis walked over to a dogwood tree and bent for a hoop of rope. Dane started up the hill toward where he'd left his axe. Before the men came in for lunch, they ducked their heads under the faucet at the side of the house, and so they walked in, dripping wet, squeegeeing their faces with their hands. Earl actually shook himself all over, like a dog, as he took his seat. Mr. Whitshank sat at the head of the table, Mrs. Whitshank at the foot. Abby sat between Dane and Landis. She and Dane were a good 18 inches apart, but he slid his foot over so that it was touching hers. He kept his eyes on his plate, though, as if he and she had nothing to do with each other. Mr. Whitshank was holding forth on Billie Holiday. She had died a couple of days before, and Mr. Whitshank couldn't see why people were so cut up about it.
"Always sounded to me like she couldn't hold on to a note," he said. "Her voice would go slippy-slidey, and sometimes she'd mislay the tune."
He had a way of rotating his face slowly from one side of the table to the other as he spoke, so as to include all his listeners. Abby felt like some sort of disciple hanging on her master's every word, which she suspected was his purpose. Then she altered her vision, she was good at that, and imagined she was sitting at a table of threshers or corn pickers or such, one of those old-time harvest gatherings, and this cheered her up. When she had a home of her own, she wanted it to be just as expansive and welcoming as the Whitshanks, with strays dropping by for meals and young people talking on the porch. Her parents' house felt so closed. The Whitshanks' house felt open. No thanks to Mr. Whitshank. But wasn't that always the way? It was the woman who set the tone.
"Now, the kind of music I favor myself," Mr. Whitshank was saying, "is more on the order of John Philip Sousa. I assume you all know who I'm talking about. Redcliffe, who am I talking about?"
"The March King," Red said, with his mouth full. He was deep in a leg of fried chicken.
"March King," Mr. Whitshank agreed. "Any of you recall the City's Service Band of America?"
No one did, apparently. They hunkered lower over their plates.
"Program on the radio," Mr. Whitshank said. "No kind of music but marches. Stars and Stripes Forever and the Washington Post March, my favorite. I like to have a fit when they took it off the air."
Abby searched for any trace in him of the wild boy from Yancey County. She could see why some might call him good-looking, with that straight-edged face of his and not a sign of a paunch even in his 50s or maybe 60s. But his clothes were so proper. Almost a caricature of properness. He had corrected the wayward lapel by now, and his eyes had a disenchanted droop at the outside corners. There were gnarly purple veins on the backs of his hands and distinct black dots of whiskers stippling his chin. Oh, let Abby not ever get old! She pressed her left ankle against Dane's ankle and passed the biscuits on to Landis.
"My father thinks Billie Holiday's the greatest," Dane offered.
He took a swig of his iced tea and then leaned back, clearly at ease.
"He says Baltimore's biggest claim to fame is Billie Holiday used to scrub front stoops downtown for a quarter apiece."
"Well, I and your father will have to agree to disagree," Mr. Whitshank said.
Then he gave a quick frown.
"Who is your father?"
"Dick Quinn," Dane said.
"Quinn as in Quinn Marketing?"
"None other."
"Will you be going into the family business?"
"Nope," Dane said.
Mr. Whitshank waited. Dane stared back at him pleasantly.
"I would think that would be a fine opportunity,"
Mr. Whitshank said after a moment.
Me and Pop tend not to see eye to eye, Dane told him. Besides, he's ticked off because I got fired from my job.
He seemed perfectly comfortable volunteering the information. Mr. Whitshank frowned again.
What'd they fire you for? He asked.
Just didn't work out, I guess, Dane said.
Well, I tell Redcliffe, I say, whatever you do in life, do your best. I don't care if it's hauling trash. You do it the best it's ever been done, I say. Take pride in it. Getting fired? It's a black mark on your record forever. It'll hang around to haunt you.
This was at a savings and loan, Dane said. I have no plans to make my career in savings and loans, believe me.
The point is, what reputation you get. What opinion your community has of you. Now, you may not feel that a savings and loan is your be-all and your end-all.
How could this man have been the hero of Mrs. Whitshank's romance? Whether you found it dashing or tawdry, at least it had been a romance, complete with intrigue and scandal and a wrenching separation. But Junior Whitshank was dry as a bone, droning on relentlessly while the other diners ate their food in dogged silence. Only his wife was looking at him, her face alight with interest as he discussed the value of hard labor, then the deplorable lack of initiative in the younger generation, then the benefits conferred by having lived through the Great Depression. If young folks today had lived through a depression the way he had lived through a depression. But then he broke off to call.
Ah, going out with your buddies?
It was Merrick he was addressing. She was crossing the hall, heading toward the front door, but she stopped and turned to face him.
Yep, she said. Don't wait supper.
Her hair had become a mass of bubbly black curls that bounced all over her head.
Merrick's fiancé now. He's gone into his family's business, Mr. Whitshank told the others. Doing a fine job, too, I gather. Course, we couldn't call him a practical fellow. Doesn't know how to change his own oil, even. Can you believe it?
Well, toodaloo, Merrick said, and she trilled her fingers at the table and left. Her father blinked, but then picked up his thread. The spoiledness of the rich and their complete inability to do for themselves. But Abby had stopped listening. She felt suddenly hopeless, defeated by his complacent, self-relishing drawl, his not-quite-right, I and your dad, and his trying-too-hard northern eyes, his greedy attention to the details of class and privilege. But Mrs. Whitshank went on smiling at him, while Red just helped himself to another slice of tomato. Earl was stacking biscuits three high on the rim of his plate, as if he planned to take them home. Ward had a shred of chicken stuck to his lower lip.
All of which, Mr. Whitshank was saying, shows why you would never, ever, under any circumstances, knuckle under to these people. I'm talking to you, Redcliffe.
Red stopped salting his tomato slice and looked up. He said,
Me? Why, you would not kowtow to them. Butter them up. Soft soap them. Tell them, Yes, Mr. Barkalow, and No, Mr. Barkalow, and Whatever you say, Mr. Barkalow. Oh, we wouldn't want to discommode you, Mr. Barkalow.
Red was cutting into his tomato slice now, not meeting his father's eyes or even appearing to hear him, but his cheekbones had a raw, scratched look, as if they'd been raked by someone's fingernails.
"Oh, Mr. Barkalow," Mr. Whitshank said in a simpering voice, "is this mutually agreeable to you?"
"We got that trunk down, boss," Landis said. "Got her just about flat to the ground."
Abby wanted to hug him. Mr. Whitshank was preparing to say more, but he paused and looked over at Landis.
Oh,
he said.
Well, good. Now all's we have to do is wait for Mitch to finish lunch at his dern mother-in-law's.
I wouldn't hold my breath, boss. You ever met his mother-in-law? Woman is a cooking fiend. 7 children, all of them married, all with children of their own, and every Sunday after church they all get together at her house and she serves 3 kinds of meat, 2 kinds of potato, salad, pickles, vegetables.
Abby sat back in her chair. She hadn't realized how tightly she had been clenching her muscles. She wasn't hungry anymore. And when Mrs. Whitshank urged another piece of chicken on her, she mutely shook her head.
Another thing, Red said.
He had paused next to Abby as the men were leaving the dining room. Abby, collecting a fistful of dirty silverware, turned to look at him.
If you're thinking you shouldn't come to the wedding because it's too short of a notice, he said, that wouldn't be a problem, I promise. A lot of people Merrick invited are staying away. All those friends of Pookie Vanderlyn's, and their moms and dads, too, they've mostly said no. We're going to end up with way too much food at the reception, I bet.
I'll keep that in mind, Abby told him, and she gave him a quick pat on the arm as if to thank him. But what she really meant to convey was that she had already put his father's tirade out of her mind, and she hoped that he would do the same. Dane, waiting for Red in the doorway, sent her a wink. He liked to poke fun at Red's devotion sometimes, referring to him as your feller. Usually this made her smile, but today she just went back to her table clearing, and after a moment he and Red walked on out to join the others. She set the silverware next to the kitchen sink where Mrs. Whitshank was washing glasses, and then she returned to the dining room. There stood Mr. Whitshank scooping a gooey chunk of peach cobbler from the baking dish with his fingers. He froze when he saw Abby, but then he lifted his chin defiantly and popped the chunk into his mouth. With showy deliberation, he wiped his fingers on a napkin. Abby said, "It must be hard to be you, Mr. Whitshank." His fingers stilled on the napkin. He said,
"What's that you say?"
"You're glad your daughter's marrying a rich boy, but it irks you rich boys are so spoiled. You want your son to join the gentry, but you're mad when he's polite to them. I guess you just can't be satisfied, can you?"
"Missy, you've got no business taking that tone with me," he said.
Abby felt as if she were about to run out of breath, but she stood her ground. "Well," she asked, "can you?"
"I'm proud of both my children," Mr. Whitshank said in a steely voice, "which is more than your daddy can say for you, I reckon, with that disrespectful tongue of yours."
"My father is very proud of me," she told him.
"Well, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, considering where you come from."
Abby opened her mouth, but then closed it. She snatched up the cobbler dish and marched out to the kitchen with it, her back very straight and her head high. Mrs. Whitshank had left off washing dishes to start drying some of those that were sitting on the drain board. Abby took the towel from her, and Mrs. Whitshank said, "Why, thank you, honey," and returned to the sink. She didn't seem to notice how Abby's hands were shaking. Abby felt bitterly triumphant, but also wounded in some way, cut to the quick. How dare he say a word about where she came from? He, of all people, with his shady, shameful past. Her family was very respectable. They had ancestors they could brag about. A great-great-grandfather, for instance, who had once rescued a king. Granted, the rescue was merely a matter of helping to lift a carriage wheel out of a rut in the road, but the king had nodded to him personally, it was believed. And a great-aunt out west who'd gone to college with Willa Cather, although it was true that the great-aunt hadn't known at the time that Willa Cather existed. Oh, there was nothing lower class about the Daltons, nothing second-rate,
and their house might be on the smallish side, but at least they got along with their neighbors.
Mrs. Whitshank was talking about dishwashing machines. She just didn't see the need, she was saying. She said, "Why, some of my nicest conversations have been over a sink full of dishes. But Junior thinks we ought to get a machine. He's all for going out and buying one."
"What does he know about it?" Abby demanded.
Mrs. Whitshank was quiet a moment. Then, "Oh," she said, "he just wants to make my life easier, I guess."
Abby fiercely dried a platter.
"People don't always understand, Junior," Mrs. Whitshank said. "But he's a better man than you know, Abby, honey."
"Huh," Abby said. Mrs. Whitshank smiled at her.
"Could you check out on the porch, please?" she asked, "and see if there's any dishes?"
Abby was glad to leave. She might have said something she'd be sorry for. No one was sitting on the porch. She picked up Merrick's cereal bowl and her spoon, and then she straightened and surveyed the lawn. At the moment, both chainsaws were silent. The air seemed oddly bright. Evidently, that naked trunk had made more difference than she had suspected. It was lying flat now, pointing toward the street, and Landis was untying a length of rope that had been looped around its circumference. Dane had paused for a cigarette. Earl and Ward were loading the wheelbarrow, and Red was standing next to the sheared-off stump with his head bowed. From his posture, Abby thought at first that he was brooding about what had happened at lunch, and she turned away quickly so he wouldn't know she had seen. But in the act of turning, she realized that what he was doing was counting tree rings. After all Red had been through today, the grueling physical effort and the din and the punishing heat, the altercation with the neighbor and the painful scene with his father, Red was calmly studying that stump to find out how old it was. Why did this hearten her so? Maybe it was the steadiness of his focus. Maybe it was his immunity to insult or his lack of resentment. "Oh, that," he seemed to be saying. "Never mind that. All families have their ups and downs. Let's just figure the age of this poplar."
Abby felt buoyed by a kind of airiness at her center, like the airiness of the lawn once that trunk had been felled. She stepped back into the house so lightly that she made almost no sound at all.
"What's going on out there?" Mrs. Whitshank asked.
She was wiping a counter. The last of the pots and pans had been dried and put away. Abby said, "Well, they got the trunk down, but Mitch hasn't shown up yet. Dane is taking a cigarette break, and Ward and Earl and Landis are clearing the yard, and Red is counting tree rings."
"Tree rings?" Mrs. Whitshank asked. Then, perhaps imagining that Abby had no knowledge whatsoever of the natural world, she said,
"Oh, he must be guessing its age."
"He was just standing there, after all that fuss, wondering how old a poplar was," Abby said. And all at once she felt on the verge of tears. She had no idea why.
"He's a good man, Mrs. Whitshank," she said.
Mrs. Whitshank glanced up in surprise, and then she smiled, a serene, contented, radiant smile that turned her eyes into curls.
"Why, yes, honey, he is," she said.
Then Abby went out to the porch again and settled in the swing. It was the prettiest afternoon, all breezy and yellow-green with a sky the unreal blue of a Noxzema jar. And in a minute, she was going to tell Red she'd like to ride with him to the wedding. For now, though, she was saving that up, hugging it close to her heart. She nudged a porch floorboard with her foot to set the swing in motion, and she swung slowly back and forth, absently tracing the familiar, Sandy feeling undersides of the armrests with her fingertips. Her eyes were on Dane now. She watched him with a distant feeling of sorrow. She saw how he dropped his cigarette, how he ground it beneath his heel, how he picked up his axe and sauntered over to a branch. What a world! What a world! And then the line that came after that one. Who would have thought, the witch had asked, that a good little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness? But Abby stood up from the swing, even so, and started walking toward Red, and with every step she felt herself growing happier and more certain. Part 3. A Bucket of Blue Paint. Chapter 10. Every ground floor room but the kitchen had double pocket doors, and above each door was a fretwork transom for the air to circulate in the summer. The windows were fitted so tightly that not even the fiercest winter storm could cause them to rattle. The second-floor hall had a chamfered railing that pivoted neatly at the stairs before descending to the entrance hall. All the floors were aged chestnut. All the hardware was solid brass. Doorknobs, cabinet knobs, even the two-pronged hooks meant to anchor the cords of the navy blue linen window shades that were brought down from the attic every spring. A ceiling fan with wooden blades hung in each room upstairs and down, and out on the porch there were three. The fan above the entrance hall had a 6.5-foot wingspan. Mrs. Brill had wanted a chandelier in the entrance hall, a glittery one, all crystal, shaped like an upside-down wedding cake. Silly woman. Junior had dissuaded her by pointing out the impracticality. Any time the tiniest cobweb was spotted trailing from a prism, he would need to send a workman over with a 16-foot stepladder. He failed to disclose that for another client, he had once designed an ingenious cable and winch lift system to raise and lower a chandelier at will. His main objection, of course, was that a chandelier would not have been in keeping with the house. This was a plain house, in the way that a handcrafted blanket chest is plain. Simple, but impeccably built, as Junior, who had built it, should know. He had overseen every detail, setting his hand to every part of it, except those parts that somebody else could do better, like the honeycombing of tiny black-and-white ceramic tiles in the bathroom, laid by two brothers from Little Italy who didn't speak any English. The stairway, though, with the newel posts running clean through the hand-cut openings in the treads, and those pocket doors that glided almost silently into their respective walls, those were Junior's. He was a brash and hasty man in all other areas of life, a man who coasted through stop signs without so much as a toe on the brake, a man who bolted his food and guzzled his drinks and ordered a stammering child to, "Come on, spit it out!" But when it came to constructing a house, he had all the patience in the world. Mrs. Brill had also wanted velvet-flocked wallpaper in the living room, fitted carpets in the bedrooms, and red and blue stained glass in the fanlight above the front door. None of which she got. Ha! Junior won just about every argument. Mostly, as with the chandelier, he cited impracticalities. But when he needed to, he was not averse to bringing up the issue of taste. "Now, I don't know why, Mrs. Brill," he would say, "but that is just not done. The Remingtons didn't do that, nor the Warings either," naming two families in Guildford whom Mrs. Brill especially admired. Then Mrs. Brill would retreat. "Well, you know best, I suppose." And Junior would proceed as he had originally intended. This was the house of his life, after all, the way a different type of man would have a love of his life. and against any sort of logic, he clung to the conviction that he would someday be living here. Even after the Brills moved in and their cluttery decorations choked the airy rooms, he remained serenely optimistic. And when Mrs. Brill started talking about how isolated she felt, how far from downtown, when she went to pieces after she found those burglar tools in the sunroom, he heard the click of his world settling into its rightful place. At last the house would be his. As it had been all along, really. Sometimes, in the weeks when he was sprucing the place up before he installed his family, he drove over in the early morning just to take a walk through, to relish the thrillingly empty rooms and the non-squeaking floorboards and the sturdy faucet handles above the bathroom sink. Mrs. Brill had wanted handles she'd seen in a Paris hotel, faceted crystal knobs the size of ping-pong balls. In Junior's opinion, though, the only sensible design was a chubby white porcelain cross, easiest to turn with soapy fingers, and for once Mr. Brill had spoken up and agreed with him. He liked to gaze up the stairs and imagine his daughter sweeping down them, an elegant young woman in a white satin wedding gown. He envisioned the dining room table lined with a double row of grandchildren, mostly boys, his son's boys, to carry on the Whitshank name. They would all have their faces turned in Junior's direction, like sunflowers turned to the sun, listening to him hold forth on some educational topic. Maybe he could assign a topic each night at the start of the meal. Music or art or current events. A ham or perhaps a roast goose would sit in front of him waiting to be carved, and the water would be served in stemmed goblets, and the salad forks would have been refrigerated ahead of time, as he had observed the maid doing in the Remington's house in Guildford. Everything till now had been makeshift, his ragtag upbringing, his hidey-hole courtship, his limping along marriage, and his shabby little rented house in a run-down neighborhood. But now that was about to change. His real life could begin. Then Linny Mae had to go and interfere with the porch swing. In the Brills' time, the porch swing had been an ugly white wrought-iron affair, featuring sharp-edged curlicues that gouged a person's spine. Its rust-pocked figure-eight hooks made a screechy, complaining sound, and the heavy chains could seriously pinch your fingers if you gripped them wrong. But Mrs. Brill had swung in that swing as a little girl, she'd told Junior, and it was clear from the lingering way she spoke how fondly she looked back on that little girl, how she cherished the notion of her cute little childhood self. So Junior had had to allow it. When the Brills moved out, they left behind all their porch furniture because they were going to an apartment. Mrs. Brill told Junior in a sad little voice to be sure and look after her swing. And Junior said, "Yes, ma'am, I'll certainly do that." The moment they were gone, though, he climbed up on a ladder and unhooked the swing himself. He knew what he wanted in its stead, a plain wooden bench swing varnished in a honey tone, with a row of lathed spindles forming the back and supporting each armrest. It should hang by special ropes that were whiter and softer than ordinary ropes, easier on the hands, and when it moved there should be no sound at all, or at most just a genteel creak such as he imagined you would hear from the sails on a sailboat. He had seen such a swing back home at Mr. Muldoon's. Mr. Muldoon managed the mica mines, and his house had a long front porch with varnished floorboards, and the steps were varnished as well, and so was the swing. Junior couldn't find this swing ready-made, and he had to commission one. It cost a fortune. He didn't tell Linny how much. She asked, because money was an issue, The down payment on the house had just about ruined them. But he said, "What difference does it make? There's not a chance on this earth I would live in a place with a white lace swing out front."
It arrived raw, as he'd specified, so that it could be finished to the shade he envisioned.